Hi, dear followers. Africa Health Exhibition and Congress 2018 is about to start, and we remind you that the show will take place in Johannesburg from 29th to 31st of May. One of the speakers who will take part in this Congress is Professor Andreas Engelbrecht, consultant in emergency medicine at Steve Biko Hospital of Pretoria, as well as adjunct professor at the Division of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pretoria, South Africa. We are in line with him today, and we will talk about toxicology and relative medications. So, good afternoon, Professor, and thank you for your time.
Good afternoon, Laura. It's nice to be speaking to you here from South Africa.
The same for us, Professor. So, in your experience and in your opinion, what are the most common poisonings a person can come up with?
Okay, so in our experience here at the Steve Biko Academic Hospital, which is a major academic hospital in Pretoria, is that patients are often poisoned by medications, drugs that they are prescribed if they take an overdose. Then we also see that patients comes in that have taken street drugs. That would be things like heroin and cocaine and other street drugs that we have here. Alcohol intoxication is very common. And we also see that patients come in with non-drug chemicals, for example, pesticides like organophosphates. Those would be the common poisonings that we encounter in our hospital, and I think that is probably fairly common in many other hospitals in South Africa as well.
Of course, envenomations cannot be treated the same way. In case of snake bite, what are the medicines to administer, and how do you recognize, is it a venomous bite or not a venomous one? Which are the symptoms in case of a venomous bite of the patient?
Okay, so in South Africa, we've got a variety of snake species. There's about 160 snake species, but out of that 160 snake species, there's only about 16 species that's really venomous. So I quickly want to just talk about the symptoms that patients might present with. We broadly categorize the snake, the venomous snakes, into cytotoxic snakes, neurotoxic snakes, and hemotoxic snakes. The cytotoxic snakes, and that would, for example, be the puff adder and the Mozambican spitting cobra, they would cause tissue damage. So if they would bite a person, that person's limb, if the person was bitten on the limb, would swell. The limb would be very painful. Blisters would form on the limb. And they can even develop something that we call a serocompartment syndrome. And that's a very common phenomenon in snake bites, where the person's limb almost looked like a compartment syndrome that you would see in a fracture. It's tight, it's stiff, it's painful. And it's really not a compartment syndrome. It just looks very similar. You actually don't need to do a fasciotomy. Those patients just need antivenom. Going on to the symptomatology, patients that are bitten by neurotoxic snakes, in South Africa, very dangerous neurotoxic snakes would, for example, be the black mamba and the Cape cobra. Those patients would present similar to someone that's been injected with the kind of neuromuscular blocking agents that we use in anesthesiology. So they would develop progressive weakness. Their respiratory muscles would be paralyzed. They would increasingly find it difficult to breathe. They might have difficulty in swallowing. Their pupils will become dilated. Those patients need urgent antivenom, and if they are already far along, they would need intubation and ventilation. Then the last type of symptomatology patients can present with are patients that are bitten by hemotoxic snakes. This causes a syndrome of bleeding, and a typical snake would be the boomslang, and it causes really a consumption coagulopathy. And initially the patients are asymptomatic. They don't have symptoms. They don't have a lot of pain. Often for that reason, they present late. And then they would just start bleeding after several hours. They start bleeding from the site of the bite. They would start bleeding under the skin, develop big bruises, and start bleeding from the upper GIT. They can have genitourinary tract bleeding, and these patients also need to receive antivenom. In terms of the drugs that can be used for these envenomations, in Southern Africa, there is a polyvalent antivenom. This polyvalent antivenom is produced from horse serum, and it covers the venomous bites of about 10 of the most venomous snakes. So this can be administered to a patient when the patient presents with a typical syndrome of one of these venomous bites, or if the snake has been positively identified. The issue here is that it often can cause allergic or anaphylactic reactions, and research has really shown that the best way to prevent these kind of anaphylactic reactions is to administer subcutaneous adrenaline to the patient prior to administration of this polyvalent antivenom. So we would give, for example, 0.25 milligrams of adrenaline subcutaneously prior to the administration of the polyvalent antivenom. There's also a monovalent antivenom, and that only covers the boomslang, the snake that I already spoke about that causes the hemotoxic envenomation. Prior to giving antivenom, it's also very important that all the resuscitation equipment must be ready, everything ready for airway management, must have good IV lines up and running, and you must have all the equipment prepared, and specifically, you must also have adrenaline drawn up for in case the patient develops anaphylaxis. Something else that must be given to patients that are bitten by these venomous snakes would be to give them a booster of tetanus vaccine, because some of these snakes, particularly the cytotoxic ones, can cause quite a lot of tissue necrosis, and that would be a kind of place where tetanus could potentially develop. So boosting the tetanus would also be very important.
Yes. And regarding mushroom poisoning, are there different types of mushrooms that can cause poisoning? And in this case, which are the symptoms and how do you act in such cases?
Right. Okay. So mushroom poisoning is something that occurs throughout the world. Mushroom species occur all over the world. There's approximately 10,000 species of mushrooms, and people are discovering new species. But about out of that 10,000 species, there's about 50 to 100 mushrooms that are really poisonous. Now, patients who present with ingestion of poisonous mushroom, the first pull that is very important is the time since the exposure to the poisonous mushroom. Most poisonous mushrooms will cause symptoms to occur within about 30 minutes to 2 hours. But the most lethal of all the poisonous mushrooms actually have a delay in symptom onset. This mushroom is called Amanita phalloides. It occurs worldwide and causes deaths in many countries all over the world. So when people eat Amanita mushrooms, these brown, greenish-brown mushrooms, relatively big mushrooms that typically would grow in forests, typically close to oak trees and pine trees, they would then eat these mushrooms, and initially there wouldn't be symptoms. But then it can take up between 6 and 24 hours before symptoms develop. The symptoms that patients then will get would be something like a food poisoning type of diarrhea. So it's a watery, profuse type of diarrhea. When they present to an emergency department, it often gets diagnosed or misdiagnosed as a gastroenteritis, and they get maybe intravenous fluid, they get rehydrated, and then they get discharged. Now, what happens then after this rehydration is there's a honeymoon period that lasts between 24 and 48 hours after they've had this gastroenteritis picture. And when they then return to the emergency department, they usually have permanent hepatic and liver failure. Right. So it's very, very important to understand this delayed symptom onset in Amanita phalloides poisoning. Let me then just say one or two things about the management of mushroom poisoning and specifically Amanita poisoning. I think it's very important that if a patient has got a history that is potentially been poisoned by something like Amanita, that we must give them activated charcoal. Activated charcoal is usually a black powder and can be given if a person presents within 1 to 2 hours of the poisoning. Excuse me.
No problem.
In mushroom poisoning, you'd also consider giving market dose of activated charcoal because there's an intrahepatic recirculation in Amanita phalloides poisoning. If a person presents later, which often happens, as I just described, obviously activated charcoal will not be effective. And in those cases, and in all cases of Amanita poisoning, there is an antidote. The antidote is called psilocybin. And it's usually given intravenously in a dose of 5 milligrams as a loading dose, and is then followed up with a dose of 20 milligrams per kilogram that's administered over 24 hours. Other medications that are often given for Amanita phalloides poisoning would be penicillin G in very high doses to compete with at the hepatocyte with the amatoxin. People sometimes give the antidote that you normally give for paracetamol, which is called N-acetylcysteine, but it is not really very effective. It's mostly when there is uncertainty whether the poisoning is mushroom or whether it's a paracetamol poisoning. One or two other mushrooms that's also important, there is a mushroom called Amanita muscaria. This mushroom is the one that you often see on the little children's book. It's the one that's got a red cap and white dots on it. That mushroom is, in fact, poisonous. It contains a poisonous substance called muscimol, and it sort of causes an anticholinergic syndrome, which I'm going to speak about a little bit later on as well. And then, of course, there's magic mushrooms. This is the psilocybin mushrooms, and they cause effects very similar to LSD. They work on the serotonergic mechanism. They make us feel euphoric and happy. If somebody overdoses on them, they can cause hypothermia as well. Most of the time, we need to cool the people down. We need to cool them down physically with a fan, with blankets if they're hypothermic. We need to give them a benzodiazepine to calm them down. And most of the time, it's really self-limiting. And then the last mushroom that I'll mention is the coprinus mushroom or the ink cap mushroom. Some people and some species of inky cap is actually quite edible, but if it is taken with alcohol, it can cause a disulfiram type of reaction, and that would also then need supportive management. So that is really just in brief, some examples of poisonous mushrooms, and then definitely something about the Amanita phalloides mushroom, which is the most poisonous of all mushrooms.
Yes. And so poisoning can be caused also by plants. I suppose that it's something the same as mushroom poisoning, but in particular, how the symptoms are. So what are the symptoms in case of plant poisoning, and what are the correct treatments in these cases?
Right. So plant poisoning is also something that is common in toxicology. Most plant poisonings are benign, and that is where, for example, a child just puts a small piece of a plant in his mouth or her mouth, and it's really just that experimental phase in their development where they really put things in their mouth. And most of those poisonings are not very serious. And it's more about really calming the parents down and explaining to them than it is about having to manage the patient. The more serious plant poisonings happen when adults or children take bigger amounts of plant material as food, and this plant happens to be poisonous, or when they take a plant because they think the plant will be something like a drug causing mind-altering effects. And then they usually take more, and for those reasons, it is more dangerous. So I'm going to give an example of a plant like the Atropa belladonna or the Datura stramonium. These two are both plants that contain atropine and scopolamine, and they cause an anticholinergic syndrome. So if a patient would have ingested that kind of plant, they would come in with a typical full-blown anticholinergic syndrome. They would be blind at the back, as we call it, from pupillary dilatation, bad as a hatter, with the central nervous system effects, hot as a hair, because they're not producing sweat and they're vasodilating, red as a beet, dry as a bone, again, because they're not producing sweat, full as a flask, because they have urinary retention, and fast as a pink flamingo, they've got a tachycardia. Mm-hmm. Now, if a patient presents like that, we're going to first have to calm the person down, put the person in the resuscitation area. If they're very agitated, we have to use, for example, a benzodiazepine intravenously just to calm them down. If they have taken the plant material less than an hour before presentation, there's still the possibility of giving activated charcoal to absorption or to absorb the poison in the gastrointestinal tract. When you give activated charcoal, it's just very important the patient must not have a suppressed level of consciousness because aspiration is dangerous in activated charcoal, so they must be fully awake. They must also not have an eyelid. In other words, their bowel must be moving, so you have to listen for bowel sounds before you give activated charcoal. And then once you've given them activated charcoal and you've calmed them down, you've given them intravenous fluids, if necessary, you put in a catheter just to relieve the bladder, there is an antidote to these anticholinergic plants, which is called physostigmine. It is an antidote that can be administered intravenously. It's very effective to reverse all the effects of anticholinergic plants, and it should be given in a dose of about 0.5 to 1 milligram intravenously. There is a caution with giving physostigmine. Physostigmine should only be given in cases where it's a pure anticholinergic syndrome. It should never be given in a situation where it is a drug, for example, tricyclic antidepressants, that is a multi-receptor blocker with anticholinergic effects, because in those cases, physostigmine can cause problems like bradycardia and can lower the threshold procedure. So physostigmine is only for pure anticholinergic poisonings. And then to make sure that that is the case, it would be important to take an EKG from the patient and make sure that there's no broadening of the QRS complexes before physostigmine is actually administered to reverse the effects of such anticholinergic plants.
Very clear, Professor.
That is it.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, as a matter of fact, it is not so uncommon to come up with an envenomation. Is it correct?
Well, I mean, it's actually fairly common if you consider all the possible plants and insects and things that we find out there in nature that some other kind of envenomation or poisoning can quite easily happen.
Yes, and so in order to avoid envenomations in general, which are the precautions people should bear in mind before having walks and day trips in the nature, or also maybe just asking their houses, for example?
Right. Okay. So I think, you know, we as city dwellers are not very used to being out there in nature. I think one of the first things that we just have to remind ourselves when we go out is that we must develop awareness. Awareness simply means you must know or take note of what's going on around you. Take note of the plants around you. Take note of the animals around you, so that, you know, you can avoid let's say, an insect or a snake or whatever that may come your way. I think awareness is a little bit more than just this. I mean, even just being aware of where you're walking, that you don't lose direction in nature, is also something important, you know. So take note of the trees or what, or the hills or whatever, so that you can keep your direction as you walk around in nature. Now, in terms of envenomations, let's say, for example, you live in a country where there's not a lot of venomous snakes, and you take a trip to a place like Southern Africa or like in the Middle East or the desert or wherever, where there is a lot of venomous snakes, you have to, and you're going to do things in nature, you should at least invest in a proper pair of shoes, you know, closed shoes, mm-hmm. That at least covers your ankle, boots. This will at least provide you with some degree of protection against bites from snakes and from stings from scorpions. Yes. In fact, many nature lovers would wear leggings, and leggings actually covers the leg all the way up to the knee, because we know most snake bites and insect stings occur below the knee. So that would be kind of some of the precautions that that one can take. Some other things that you can do, for example, if you're someone that's allergic to bees, would be to avoid wearing clothing that is very colorful, clothing with flower patterns on them. You should also avoid wearing very sweetly perfumes that have got a very sweet fragrance. Because these things all tend to attract bees and insects and so forth. Now, as far as avoiding poisonous plants is concerned, the obvious thing is don't eat any plant material, be that be leaf or stem or fruit or berry or root, unless you don't know what kind of plant you are eating, because it often happens that people eat things by mistake. But if you're in a situation where you're in a survival situation and you have to eat something, you have to eat it, and you want to consider, is this plant edible or not? There are some rules that you can apply with caution, and this is only in a life-threatening situation. So in a situation like that, generally when a berry or a fruit or something like that has got a red, bright red color, and if it's very sweet, it should be safe to eat. So you can take a small little taste of something, and just if it's red and it's sweet, generally that is an indication that it is safe. Of course, there are exceptions to the rules, so it's not something that you should do all the time, but it is something that you can use as a sort of a rule of thumb.
Yes, of course. So, okay, and you will be also a speaker during Africa Health Exhibition and Congress 2018. So what will be your intervention during the show?
Yes, I look very much forward to the Africa Health Exhibition and Congress of 2018. It's going to be a fantastic event. And I will be presenting at the conference on snake bites and scorpion stings and spider bites. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, I will also be part of a panel that will just be discussing toxicology in general, and that would include all the different topics in toxicology, including overdoses, three drugs, and all the treatment options that are available for patients that are acutely poisoned.
Okay, perfect. So very interesting, and thank you very much, Professor Engelbrecht, for your brilliant contribution and for your precious suggestions.
It's a pleasure, and it was lovely speaking to you, Laura. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, dear followers, this was Professor Engelbrecht from South Africa. Keep on following emergencylab.com for further updates. Thank you.